Welcome to The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. If police have caught a serial killer, they did it by using a DNA database in a new and controversial way. When you submit a DNA sample, what should you know about how that information might be used? That's coming up later on the program. Our top story today, when Amazon said it's looking for a second headquarters outside of Seattle, some people got worried. Is Amazon threatening to leave us? Are they shopping for better tax breaks and holding that over Seattle's head? Well, that concern just got more real. Yesterday, Amazon announced it's pausing two projects in downtown Seattle, projects that involve 7,000 jobs, while the city decides on a new tax that would cost Amazon millions. This is a tax on big businesses, and the money would pay for low-income housing and services for homeless people. Will the city drop this tax as a way to keep Amazon growing here? On the line, we have Seattle City Council Member Lisa Herbold. Welcome, Council Member.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Amazon has halted construction on a new skyscraper and might not fill another downtown building with its workers. It might lease out that space. While the city debates this employee head tax, your colleague Shama Sawant calls this blackmail. What is your reaction?
Well, you know, I've always known that a focused tax on the city's 285 largest businesses would result in some difficult conversations with those largest businesses. I think it's interesting that we're hearing most loudly from Amazon. This tax is not about Amazon. It's about really focusing our need for resources to deal with a homelessness emergency.
But it would cost Amazon $20 or $25 million a year.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. And, so what do you conclude from that?
Well, what I conclude from that is that the structure of the tax is designed in such a way that brings to light the fact that the growth of large tech companies in the city is contributing to unaffordability, both on the part of renters, on potential homeowners, and businesses. And we talk a lot about how rents have been driven up and home prices have been driven up, but business space has, the rents on business space has been driven up as well.
Well, since you think that growth contributes to unaffordability, I could imagine you seeing Amazon's announcement as good news. Amazon slowing its development a little would mean less homelessness?
No, I don't see it as good news. I see it as part of the conversation that we're having about income inequality in the city and in this nation. There's a great quote from local economist Dick Conway in his piece called Washington State and Local Tax System, Dysfunction and Reform, where he writes, "High-tech jobs create two or three other jobs in the economy through the multiplier process. These workers and their families place demands on the public sector for schools, roads, and safety. If the added cost of these public services and goods were to fall disproportionately on low and middle income households, as they do under Washington State's sales-based tax system, these households, in effect, are subsidizing the high-tech companies and their employees." This is the conversation we need to have in this city and in this country.
Well, so yes, that's why I'm asking. Given the taxes Amazon already pays, property, real estate, and excise, and on, is their growth in Seattle, continued growth, a net benefit to the poor because of that multiplier effect, how the money spreads, or a net cost to the poor on balance?
It could be. It could be if we had a tax structure that allowed us to generate the revenue that is necessary to keep up with the cost of services for a growing population. The way it stands now, you know, Washington State's the most regressive state in the nation as far as our tax structure, and Seattle is the most regressive city in Washington State. That makes Seattle the most regressive city in the nation. So we need to correct this. And it's interesting to me that this is happening while the HQ2 bid is going on, because you know the message I've been trying to send to folks who are seeking Amazon to join their economic infrastructure in their cities is that you need to have in place structures for this economic engine to contribute to transportation needs, contribute to affordable housing needs, and contribute in a way that is proportional to their impact to the tax base for goods and services.
Well, that's what you want a business to do, but Amazon maybe can get a better deal than it's getting in Seattle. Does Amazon have a moral obligation to pay this tax, this head tax?
I think it's a good business decision. I mean, they have invested a lot of money in this city. That is a given. There are a lot of employees in the city, and this is a great place to do business. Washington State was listed as having the best economy in the country across three measures, across innovation potential and economic growth and economic activity. And then just last month, Washington State leads the nation in personal income growth, as reported by the Bureau of Economic Analysis. So to me, it's less of whether or not there's a moral obligation. It's more about whether or not it makes good business sense, because, you know, part of making and keeping this a great place to do business is participating in addressing the dire needs of people who are just barely getting by in the city, and again, a large part because of the competition that has been created for housing from a lot of high-income earners moving into the city.
Well, if the question is whether this makes good business sense, that's Amazon's decision to make, and it sounds like they've already decided, and that, I assume, isn't that what you take away from their saying they're putting a pause on these two projects until you decide whether to tax them?
You know, I'm not going to speculate about the eventual outcome of this discussion. I mean, I think, like I said at the start, this is part of the difficult conversation that I think many of us knew we would be having. I had hoped we would be having it a different way.
Mm-hmm.
I think we'll get through this and we'll have a better outcome.
Seattle City Councilmember Lisa Herbold, just a couple of more questions. Last night there was a pretty raucous public hearing in Ballard, and the official topic was this proposed head tax. A group of people showed up to say Seattle is not easing homelessness or affordability with the money it's already got. And this is former City Councilmember Kirsten Harris Talley trying to engage the crowd.
You want folks to listen to you because you have a lot to say and you want to go home to your families. I hear what you're saying. I do, as much as I can, over screaming voices.
What did you learn, council member, from that passionate public hearing?
Well, I learned that there are a lot of frustrated and angry people out there, and I gained a lot of respect for former City Council member Kirsten Harris Talley, who I already had a lot of respect for. She stepped into a really difficult role that was unplanned.
What did you learn from the people who showed up? They wanted you to hear their message that the city's not easing homelessness with what it's got.
I heard that they're angry and frustrated. We had planned the beginning portion of the meeting to actually share some information that was not allowed to occur. The folks in the room insisted that we just have an open mic. So I think there was an important opportunity to provide some information about the city's efforts to spend both human services dollars in its homelessness investment strategy with required reportable outcomes from providers, as well as our housing levy investments.
Okay.
But that conversation was not allowed to occur, unfortunately.
Okay. Sounds like you were unmoved, unchanged after last night's hearing. A couple more questions. So bottom line, before Amazon's announcement, my understanding is 5 of the 9 city council members were supporting this head tax, including you. So just real quick, number one, have you changed your vote?
I haven't.
Okay.
We had a committee meeting yesterday,
mm-hmm.
And you know we're continuing the schedule of meetings that we've calendared.
Okay.
To continue the deliberative process.
So, and do you think you're saying no other council members have changed their vote, as far as you know?
Four of the five of us were out there in Ballard yesterday with the intention of talking about the proposal. Like I said, we weren't permitted to talk about the proposal, but that's what we were there to do.
Okay, no vote changes that you want to tell me about. Anyway, do you think
none that I'm aware of?
Do you think Mayor Durkan would now veto this tax if you pass it? She's said that she's concerned about an Amazon pullback. How would it affect jobs beyond tech, building, restaurants, nurses, manufacturing jobs?
Yeah, I really can't speculate on
okay.
where the mayor is on that.
Okay.
You know, we have ongoing conversations with her about this proposal and other issues of the day.
Yeah.
But I haven't connected with her since yesterday.
And if Seattle passed this employee head tax, this is a tax that big businesses would pay, roughly $500 tax on every employee. A quarter an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And it would cost Amazon $20-25 million a year. If Seattle passed it, do you think Amazon would stop at halting two projects? In other words, what are the odds Amazon shifts much more substantially to a more tax-friendly headquarters city?
I'm not typically somebody who, plays the odds or,
mm-hmm.
speculates
on
things like that.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
finally, Councilmember Herbold, one final question then. Does it matter at all? I certainly, in the atmospherics of this conversation, I hear a lot of references to Jeff Bezos being personally worth $130 billion. Does that play any role to you? Does that matter?
Again, this was never intended by the four sponsors of this legislation to be about Amazon. Again, 585 businesses would be impacted by this tax. That's 3% of the business owners in this city. I'm not really focused on the wealth of any of the individual business owners that would be impacted. I know that it's of interest to folks generally, but again, I'm really focused on getting the revenue source passed as well as the spending plan that we have for how to use the dollars in a way that's consistent with our homelessness investment strategy, with required outcomes, as well as the Office of Housing's efforts to build very low-income housing.
Seattle City Councilmember Lisa Herbold talking about the ongoing discussion. My understanding is there's going to be, is it a full council vote on May 14? Is that still the plan?
That's the plan, yeah.
Okay. Meanwhile, you co-sponsored a rental law in this city, a prohibitive landlords from screening renters based on their criminal background. There's a legal challenge to that now. Can we take a quick break and keep you here and have a discussion about that?
You can.
Excellent.
All
Thank
right.
you so much, Council
sure
members. Stay with us,
okay.
And you stay tuned, listeners. Thanks for tuning in. It's been less than a year since the city of Seattle prohibited landlords from screening renters based on their criminal background, and now the city's being sued over it. In a complaint filed this week, landlords and the state's Rental Housing Association say the new law prevents property owners from protecting themselves and their existing tenants. And one of the people suing is William Shadbolt. He's a landlord and president of the board of the Rental Housing Association of Washington. Welcome, William.
Thank you very much, Bill.
And we still have on the line Seattle City Councilmember Lisa Herbold, who co-sponsored this rental law. Thanks for staying with us, Councilmember.
Absolutely.
William, as a landlord, how does this law prevent you from protecting yourself and your tenants?
Well, I'm more concerned about my tenants. You know, the single mother that has a couple of young kids that are in one of my duplex units, she passed a criminal background check, and she would like to know who else is going to be in that house sharing the backyard with her. Mm. You know, it's definitely something that it's public record. You know, the next door neighbor can literally go onto the internet and look up criminal records. Yeah, the city of Seattle is saying to landlords, no, you can't. And we actually had an interesting one where a tenant wanted to have a roommate, and the landlord said, great. And so the tenant turned around and said, can you do a criminal background check? The answer is no. she ended up moving out of the city of Seattle because she couldn't afford to stay here without a roommate.
And William, the Rental Housing Association says the law violates your free speech rights. Explain that briefly.
Yeah, certainly. So there is precedent in the U.S. Supreme Court that basically says, you know, if there's something that's public record, the government shouldn't restrict one segment of society from being able to look at that that information.
Mm-hmm. And when he signed this bill last year, the mayor, Ed Murray, at the time, said that using criminal records in housing is unfair. This is a bit of his comment.
We know that African-American men are six times as likely to be incarcerated compared to white men. This discriminatory bar to housing falls disproportionately on those people of color, just by that statistic alone.
William, do you agree that despite its merits or not, do you agree that using criminal records in tenant screening is, in practice, discriminatory? It has a discriminatory effect.
No, because we already have existing rules around this issue before the city of Seattle came in with this onerous ordinance. So under state law, you can only look back 7 years on criminal records. And in 2016, HUD gave official guidance that on criminal records and arrest records, you've got to look at the nature of the criminal action, how long has passed since then, and kind of the nature of it, the severity of it.
Seattle City Council Member Lisa Herbold, you co-sponsored this this ordinance that's being challenged. What's your response? Shouldn't landlords be able to use their own discretion about who lives on their property?
Well, I'd first like to really respond to the concern, which I respect, the concern that folks who rent housing have for their tenants. But back when we were debating this legislation, I heard from tenants in apartment buildings managed by Pinnacle Stadium Place in Widener in response to their landlord sending out a notice to their tenants urging them to contact us in opposition to the bill. I've got quotes from six different tenants in response. One is, "I'm commenting because the property management company that manages my apartment, Widener, has put a scare alert out to us tenants under the guise of keeping us safe by advocating keeping a longer screening window. I disagree with them and fully support the policy as proposed. I think helping people who have served their time get off the streets and remove barriers to their integration back into society keeps us safer. Another one is, discrimination against ex-offenders does not keep us safe. It endangers the whole community. Housing and employment are critical to the success of ex-offenders rejoining society. Ex-offenders are seven times less likely to re-enter the criminal justice system if they have housing. I would expect anybody who is concerned about their safety of their community to support this legislation."
William, what about this rental law helping to lower barriers for people who have served their time?
Well, there's definitely a couple of different segments of the market of people who serve their time. There's people coming immediately out of prison, and they do need extra supportive help. And in fact, a former board member of the Rental Housing Association, his entire business model is housing people coming out of prison. But then there's the people that have been out of prison for quite some time and are looking for housing. And the problem is it's basic, it's economics 101, it's supply and demand. We have more demand and not enough supply of housing in the city. And what is it's manifesting, whether it's on the affordability side or the use of criminal records, the city has too much demand for the supply of housing. Now, I guess the city is looking at reducing the demand by annoying Amazon enough that they're not going to hire people here. But, you know, we would, through the entire process of this, we put forward a couple of different ideas, different alternatives that would, in a constitutional way...
What's an alternative?
So we suggested, there was two different ones that we put forward. One was kind of similar to the employment ban the box, where landlords wouldn't know about criminal records until after they'd made an offer. And then only after that, they would come back and could only turn somebody down if there was a good business reason for that.
What about that idea, Councilmember Herbold, a sort of ban the box curtain?
There's been a lot of interesting research done recently about the ban the box models, particularly for employment, but also for housing. And it actually has a greater disparate impact on people of color because people are bringing their implicit bias to the table before even beginning the screening process based on the sound of people's names, and so they're coming up unintentionally and sometimes unconsciously with other ways to screen out people who they think might be people with criminal backgrounds.
I know you disagree on that. You said there's one. Give me one more alternative, William.
Yeah. So a couple of years ago, the Rental Housing Association supported on the state level a certificate of restoration of opportunity. So one of the things that we realized is that people coming out of prison, there's a lot of occupational licenses that they cannot get because of those criminal records. And so we suggested doing a local one, kind of as a trial in the city of Seattle for housing, where somebody with a criminal record could go to an impartial panel and show that they have changed their ways.
How do they show that?
Well, it would be the time since they've lapsed since they've come out, that they've got a stable employment, maybe references from other people in society. And in then turn, they could take that to the small landlord that is our typical member at the Rental Housing Association. And, you know, we were also discussing as part of that maybe having a mitigation fund, that if a landlord did take somebody in that circumstance, they would have access to a mitigation fund.
Okay, Councilmember Herbold, what about requiring something more of someone? Just because you've served your time doesn't necessarily mean you're peaceful and honest. What about requiring more of such an applicant?
Well, again, I think one of the things that we're forgetting here is that the ability to do the kind of screening that landlords are doing right now is relatively new. New access to data has historically been less accessible. This allows landlords to reject tenants because they've been arrested or in other cases not even convicted. And so the opportunity for restoration doesn't even address the fact that landlords can screen somebody for being arrested and screen them out. And so, I mean, the basic fundamental problem is that the fundamental tenet of our justice system is that, one, only a court of law can punish somebody accused of a crime. And the impact of blocking somebody from accessing stable housing based on their criminal background violates this tenet of our justice system and is inconsistent with the rule of law. You're basically giving landlords an extrajudicial power to punish somebody.
Yeah, William, what about the unprecedented power that landlords who screen now have? That this is a different world where you can find out a lot more. But I've heard the Justice Department says 1 in 3 American adults has an arrest or a conviction record. I mean, isn't that just simply keeping too many people out of a fundamental part of living, which is having a roof over your head?
So I want to address that point that this is some kind of new thing that's just come about is absolutely untrue. The state has had the judicial information system since the 1980s. There's been easy access to judicial records provided by the state from the 1980s. Prior to that, screening companies had their own database. I talked to a friend of mine who's been in the rental housing industry for 50 years. She's been screening criminal records for 50 years. So the idea that this is just something that's recently come about is just not true. But, you know, the idea of looking at arrest records, you know, the question is this person going to be a stable tenant? If somebody's been arrested and about to go on trial, even if they're not found, not guilty, there's a likelihood they're going to have massive legal expenses. But, you know, take the example of the landlord in Wallingford that was stabbed to death, allegedly by her roommate. Now, assuming that person gets out on bail, I'm guessing they're going to be looking for another roommate situation. Now, that particular person, if they don't own their own place, if they're renting and they want to get a roommate in, they can't look at criminal records. Is that really fair?
Do you want to make a quick answer to that? And then we're about out of time. I want to wrap it up with one more question. Any response?
Well, I mean, I'm not quite sure if the question is about fairness or it's a question about liability, but, you know, landlords have never been legally required to screen for a criminal background, and so they're not liable for not screening. So this question, I think, is really a red herring.
Final question, Councilmember Herbold. When it comes to rental law, a judge already ruled against the city for making landlords accept the first qualified renter who applied. If you were to lose this legal challenge, would you say the city was being overzealous, overstepping the law, and making your constituents pay to defend that litigation?
Well, I think a lot of people who are a heck of a lot smarter than I am on the issues surrounding the first in time law feel strongly that the lower court decision was simply a bad decision. So
it's on appeal.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there are a lot of other really important principles at play around that particular case. So I'm really glad that the city attorney is moving forward with that appeal. You know, we are in a homelessness crisis in this city, and the BIPOPI report a couple years ago now identifies the barriers that people in this city have to accessing housing as our greatest challenge. And so by working on addressing these barriers, we are really trying to put into place the recommendations that report has challenged us to move forward on. You know, William's right. We have a supply challenge in the city, a supply of housing issue. But what that does is that creates a situation where landlords can cherry pick applicants, and the folks who most need housing and are most likely to not have other supports and other resources, it increases the number of people who are living on our streets.
Okay.
You know, people,
yes.
Just one other quick thing. People point to the questions that they have around our Human Services Department funding and the outcomes. We just got the 2017 numbers. There were more than 5,000 exits to permanent housing with the city's homelessness dollars. More than 5,000 exits. Mm-hmm. More people are falling in every year.
Let's end on the agreement between the two of you that housing is scarce and expensive. Lisa Herbold, Seattle City Council member, voted to pass the original rental ordinance. Thank you. William Shadbolt, President, Board of the Rental Housing Association of Washington, and a landlord himself, and will watch the legal case as the city's prohibition on landlords from screening renters based on criminal background, that is being legally challenged. William, thank you for this time.
Thank you very much.
Back with more of the news on KOW's The Record. What should you know when you submit a DNA sample? Stay tuned. The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. A California judge says authorities can collect DNA from the man accused in a series of rapes and murders that terrorized California for a decade in the 70s and 80s. This is the case of the Golden State Killer. Last week, the FBI announced they'd solved it after 40 years, and they did it by using genealogy. Detectives use DNA from a crime scene to make a fake profile on a genealogy site, they won't say which one, to find the killer's family members and follow a trail that led to former police officer Joseph DeAngelo. That raised some ethical and legal eyebrows, and I have a couple of those eyebrow raisers here with me now. Malia Fullerton, professor of bioethics at the University of Washington. Welcome, Professor.
Hello.
Steve Mercer, forensic science attorney and partner at the law firm. Is it Rakeen Mercer?
Yes, Bill. Thank you.
Rakeen Mercer. Steve Mercer, thanks for coming. So this is the Sacramento County Sheriff Scott Jones last week.
It was always going to be DNA that solved this case. So that was ultimately any investigation, that's where it was ultimately going to lead, DNA. And so we knew at that point it was good enough. We couldn't exclude him. So we had to say, all right, we need to test this DNA. And that's what we did.
Steve Mercer, how comfortable are you with using DNA the way authorities did to catch the accused Golden State Killer?
Well, it's easy to applaud the success of the Golden State Killer investigation, but DNA identification raises unique privacy concerns. Here, police created a dummy user account, uploaded an ancestry DNA profile, and searched for relatives who were then targeted for further investigation. There really are very few legal rules that apply in this area. And the starting point has to be assessing the weight of the interest in genetic privacy, which is substantial. And I think in a situation, for example, where Facebook, Cambridge Analytica, where people submitted personal information for one purpose that was then used for an entirely different purpose, caused a lot of outrage. We're in a similar situation here where people who submitted their DNA to an ancestry site are suddenly realizing that it can be put to very different uses than they ever intended.
Bioethics Professor Malia Fullerton, what's your take on the bioethics here?
Well, I generally agree. We have known for a while that putting one's genetic information in the public domain exposes people to risks to their genetic privacy. What was very unusual about this case was it was a what's referred to as a third-party interpretation site. So a direct-to-consumer genetic company like Ancestry.com or 23andMe that somebody goes to and pays for generate.
So I send my saliva to Ancestry.com.
Yeah.
Yes, or 23andMe,
and you do that for the purposes of learning things about familial relationships and ancestry.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get that information back from the company, some of these companies...
They send me a data file.
They
right?
now will give you access to your raw data file.
Yeah.
And what happened here was people who were interested in extending and getting additional information uploaded that raw data file to this third-party interpretation site, which has now since been identified. It's called GEDmatch.
GEDmatch.
And they did that intentionally in order to find people who they were closely related to, and that is what the police used to identify the serial killer.
And let's say I'm the saliva sampler. Mm-hmm. What did I agree to when I gave my data file to GEDmatch?
Well, you agreed. They have different options, but if you want relatives to find you, you agreed to have your genetic sequence accessible by other people using the third-party interpretation service, and you agreed for them to get in contact with you if they found some kind of match which suggested some kind of family history, shared family history.
So, attorney Steve Mercer, I agreed. I clicked yes, right? I told him, do what you want with it, with my DNA.
Well, if I submit my DNA to an ancestry site to learn about my genealogy, I don't expect the swab patrol to show up for my children's DNA or my brother's DNA or my parents' DNA. You know, the idea that the data was shared to identify relatives, the purpose wasn't to give law enforcement an opportunity to search my family tree to look for a suspect. That's an entirely different use, and not one that I think any reasonable person would intend when they're sharing that data to learn about their ancestry. And again, you know, I've heard many people say, well, you know, I would be happy if I had a serial rapist in my family tree for the police to then go and arrest. But
right.
There's no assurance that this is limited to serious crimes.
Why? What's the worst case scenario?
Well, the worst case scenario is what we see playing out at the local level in underregulated law enforcement databanks that contain DNA profiles from crime scenes that can't be submitted to a national regulated databank, and DNA from suspects, crime victims, and other innocent people. And those databanks are being used for very misdemeanor crimes, property crimes, you know, trespass, rogue vagabond, these types of offenses. Because you have to remember, when police are investigating a crime or collecting evidence, they're collecting DNA not just at serious crimes, but also at misdemeanor, quality of life, broken window type offenses, because swifter, cheaper, more sensitive testing allows police to extract a DNA profile from a single human cell that can be shed just by touching something. So this is really opening up a Pandora's box when this technique of familial searching that was used here, which is vastly more powerful than the forms of familial searching that have been used before, which were limited to just looking essentially for the genetic equivalent of a last name. I mean, now there's these profiles, these genetic profiles look at 700,000 locations on the human genome, which contains an awesome amount of information.
Okay.
And that is allowing police to search out to third, fourth degree relatives. And here, for example, back to great, great, great grandfather in the 1800s.
Yes.
It's just unprecedented, that power of that technology.
So then, bioethics professor Fullerton,
Steve there brought up the idea of this is not just a serial killers, it's misdemeanors and trespasses. It's a broken windows. When we think of the broken windows problem, we think of police profiling for minor accusations, profiling a poor and brown people, for example. Is there some way that I should worry about a certain kind of person being profiled by powerful DNA possessors?
Well, I mean, it can happen. I think what's interesting, and other people have pointed out, that we already have sort of disproportionate representation of ethnic minorities in forensic databases. And so one alternative ethical argument, sort of the flip side, is, well, maybe we should be using these genealogical resources, which tend to be populated more often by people of European ancestry, middle class, well-to-do, have enough disposable income in order to kind of do an ancestry test and dabble in genealogy on the side. So maybe this is righting some of those biases. However, I do agree that the way the police went about this exposed a very large number of people. They identified more than 25 families that matched this individual's DNA sample, and they had to kind of systematically step through multiple generations of family history in order to arrive at the single individual that they eventually identified. That's exposing a bunch of completely innocent people to enhanced surveillance in ways that we don't even fully know. There have been accounts. There was a particularly detailed account in the Washington Post, but we don't know exactly what the Sacramento Police Department did here in order to get to the individual that they've eventually decided is the person who left those DNA samples at those crime scenes.
Steve, we got less than 2 minutes. It sounded like you wanted to react to that.
Well, yeah, two quick points. Number one, I can't fathom how expanding law enforcement presence and intrusions into private DNA databanks is going to remedy the racial bias and prejudices that results in a disproportionate number of racial minorities in law enforcement databanks that are both regulated and unregulated. So I just reject that premise flat out. That's nothing but an invitation for a universal DNA databank.
Which might right injustices here.
It doesn't resolve the biases and prejudices that result in the problem in the first instance based on race in our criminal justice system. It just masks it. So it's not a remedy.
We're out of time, unfortunately. Forensic science attorney Steve Mercer, former chief attorney of the Forensics Division at the Office of the Public Defender of Maryland. Steve, thanks for talking this through with us.
Thank you, Bill.
And Malia Fullerton, Associate Professor of Bioethics and Humanities at University of Washington School of Medicine, talking about the legal, ethical difficulties raised by this high-profile catching of a suspected serial killer in California. You might want to know what you're in for and what your descendants are in for when you submit that saliva. Professor, thank you.
You're very welcome.
And thank you for tuning in to The Record. We're going to come right back with the writer, the essayist, music culture critic, Chuck Klosterman. Stay tuned. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. I'm deciding whether to go to the Taylor Swift show at CenturyLink Field in about 3 weeks. I'm looking at my phone right now. A group text from my friend says, "Guys, please come to Taylor Swift with me. I can't be the only dad again this year." And there's a GIF of Taylor Swift giving me a thumbs up. And I don't know what to do. I've got mixed feelings about Taylor Swift. I need some help from my next guest, essayist Chuck Klosterman. Welcome back to KUOW.
It's great to be here.
Good to talk with you again. So your new book is not all about Taylor Swift. That's just one essay in a collection called X, A Highly Specific, Defiantly Incomplete History of the Early 21st Century.
Well, actually, the X is 10.
10. Here it is right here on the book cover, and I didn't read it right.
But, well, this is a problem. This is a mistake on my end. Okay, it's like I overlooked or maybe exaggerated the average consumer's interest in Roman numerals.
Okay, so the book, one of your essays in the book is about Taylor Swift, whom you interviewed. And this is a couple few years ago.
Yeah, it was for GQ. I think, boy, it might be 4 years now, maybe?
She was promoting the 1989 album, Shake It Off.
Yes.
Yeah. And first of all, you say if you, for those listeners who don't take Taylor Swift seriously, you write at the top, if you don't take Taylor Swift seriously, you don't take contemporary music seriously. Do you still feel that way 4 years later?
Well, I mean, certainly. I mean, if you're going to say, you know, I'm a fan of contemporary mainstream music, there are some artists that, if you discount, you're essentially discounting what the idiom is. So, I mean, if you care about what's actually happening with the culture at large, Taylor Swift is someone you kind of have to care about. You don't have to like her, but you have to be aware of what she does and the space she occupies in that culture.
Right. And I wouldn't have to like her to go to her show. I could just be interested. But I've come to have mixed feelings, and you get right to it in your interview with her, actually. I don't want to think that a song is about the singer unless I'm fascinated by that singer and I like being fascinated by them. But this is inescapable with Taylor Swift. Will you talk about that for those who don't know?
I mean, Taylor Swift might be the clearest example of this, but this is actually kind of folded into pop music now, that there is a sense that the celebrity nature of these individuals is part of the experience for the listener. Okay. The idea of, say, oh, if it was, you know, 1977 or something, you're listening to a Boston song or a Foreigner song. It was almost as though, you know, the cover of the record's a spaceship. You don't even know what the band looks like.
Yep.
There's no sense that you need to know about a member of Boston to understand what's going on. The song is supposed to be about you. And now there is this idea that Taylor Swift's music is sort of good on face value and can be totally appreciated by someone who just likes the way she writes songs or what the song is about or any of those traditional reasons we like anything. But there is a second component with someone like her, which is that the music can be unpacked through sort of the understanding of her tabloid life. And particularly with someone like Taylor Swift, who pretty openly writes about almost every relationship she has, that builds sort of the meaning of these songs, that if you're trying to understand Taylor Swift, you can't really do it through her interviews or how she looks in public or the things that she does. You have to listen to her lyrics to get to her. And when you get to her is sort of when the thing changes again.
For those who don't know, for several years it's been, Taylor Swift is angry at every boyfriend and she won't stop talking about it. And then it's Taylor Swift is mad at Katy Perry in this song. And then this is kind of what snapped it for me, the song Look What You Made Me Do. Now that video is about all these different phases of Taylor Swift and her Taylor Swiftness and Taylor Swift is dead. And I feel like I'm out.
Well, okay, I guess the first thing I would say is, why do you find that problematic?
Because I'm overwhelmed by the Taylor Swiftness of it. And I don't mean, oh, I'm better than Taylor Swift. I just don't care that much about anybody else. You know?
Okay, well, here's what I think you might be feeling, because it's a common thing with Swift now. Okay, so when we talk about, human qualities of someone's personality, and you say to them, you're a very self-aware person, you have a high degree of self-awareness, that's almost always positive.
Yeah.
But when it's applied to artists, it sometimes becomes pejorative, because the listener doesn't want to feel as though they're watching this person have their own internal experience and we're watching them understand themselves. People want to feel as though, well, this person's just emoting. That emotion is real. They can't even control it. With Taylor Swift, so many of her decisions scan to people as calculated or something overly considered. Or when she is talking about the way she's perceived, she's not really talking about how that feels. It's almost like four steps removed, that she's reading a think piece about a story about her perception, about a photograph that she didn't want taken that she actually set up. And it feels like I'm part of this machine now. And as a consequence, The reputation of Taylor Swift is interesting. Her record's called Reputation. I suppose I'm playing right into this in some ways. But it has shifted since the time I wrote this story. She was more untouchable at that period. It was very rare to see someone criticize Taylor Swift during like the 1989 period and prior to that, because anytime someone criticized her, it was often taken as being, well, you are intimidated by the fact that this sort of this young female artist is able to have complete agency over her career. And it was almost seen as sexist to criticize her. But things have shifted now, partially because in some ways now Taylor Swift is in this position where people will feel like, well, she carries a lot of white privilege, and then like she had gotten to a little dust up with Nicki Minaj,
right,
which isn't part of this story. That was kind of a blow to her in some ways, because it took away this idea that she was almost an untouchable figure in the culture. Now her position in the culture is a little more fragile. I mean, it's got to be complicated to be Taylor Swift.
I'm curious. You seemed pretty positive about Taylor Swift when you wrote that essay in 2015, and I was too. Have you, like me, soured on Taylor Swift? Are we documenting her, at least temporary, downfall?
Oh, I mean, I probably like her more, to be honest. The thing that you're saying that you don't like is the thing I do like. Like,
okay.
It's interesting to me this is happening. And I can like a musical artist, or really a sports figure or a political figure, almost any kind of figure, not because I so much love what they're doing, but because I find it fascinating.
Well, I wish I could still be fascinated by her referring to her. Maybe that's the problem. Maybe somebody else, I would find it more fascinating. But this is leads to
I mean, no, there's a reversal in this. I mean, like, okay, so when the Beatles were huge, people thought they knew the Beatles, but they really didn't. It took the 70s and the 80s and all of these things to happen for people to go back into those Beatles songs and sort of find the hidden meanings that at the time people were just completely distanced from. There was a huge chasm between who the Beatles actually were and how they were being received. Well, now it's happening at the same time, and it is weirder. I mean, I'm not going to deny that. It's a weirder thing, but it's kind of how the world is now.
I love the description of the Boston album with a spaceship on it. I can't remember the name of the guy who's the genius of Boston.
Tom Schultz.
I think he had a lot of hair. I knew nothing about that guy, and I was singing those songs. So my question is it better for me to hear a song and think it's about me, because I have more than a feeling sometimes, or is it better for me to listen to a song and think it's about Taylor Swift? You know, it's about the singer.
Well, I mean, as you probably expect, it would be odd if I said, this one's definitely better than the other one, because the natural response is always, well, whatever experience you're having with music is good, that there's no right or wrong way to experience it. I will say this. A lot of times people feel as though music suddenly gets bad when they turn about 25 or 26,
mm-hmm.
or there's a whole history of this. And part of that feeling comes from the fact that when you're younger, you are taking this music in a more straightforward way. You're taking in the song before you think of anything about its meaning or its context. And when you get older, that gets harder and harder to do. You know, the thing you were saying about Boston, that is probably more of a quote-unquote pure way to experience pop music. And if purity is what you're looking for, I suppose it is superior, but that's not the only reason to like something. I mean, the reasons you find to like or dislike something aren't really that connected to the artist. It's really saying something about yourself.
Yeah. I don't want to be one of those guys who stopped listening, but I kind of did. But, you know, kids will bring it back. I'm listening to pop music again. Final question. What do I do then, Chuck? Do I go to the Taylor Swift concert at CenturyLink Field?
What day of the week is it?
Good question. May 22nd is a Tuesday.
Well, for me, a lot would depend on if there's an NBA playoff game that night. Can I ask what ticket prices are? I'm curious.
Last question. Can I borrow $400?
Is it $400? I was going to guess $125. Boy, I'm out of it, I guess.
I think that's if I took my daughter, which I think would be the idea, and this is what my wife is texting.
Yeah, I would say this. Here's my advice. If you go, take your daughter. Don't just go by yourself. That might be a bit odd. Like, unless you're carrying a notebook, people will... Well, in fact, don't carry a notebook either. That might be double odd.
Chuck Klosterman, the new book is 10, a highly specific, defiantly incomplete history of the early 21st century. And Chuck, you're at the University Bookstore on Saturday, 5:30, so we can do this in person.
It's free.
And a free event. Thanks for this.
Thanks for you.
And that's it for today. Thanks for listening. Tomorrow at noon, The Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Appreciate you tuning in.